a brief warning to all Looking Up regular listeners. This episode will have absolutely, positively, no scientific value. And it's really all my guests' fault.
Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I think we should worship the sun and moon as powerful gods and fear them.
You'll soon hear my conversation with actor, comedian, and screenwriter for the Night at the Museum series, Thomas Lennon. You might recognize his face or possibly his legs from his long stint as Lieutenant Jim Dangle on the mockumentary police TV show Reno 911.
I feel like I bring a real joie de vivre to law enforcement.
But since this is a podcast, maybe you'll recognize his overly cheery voice as Eddie, the shipboard computer on the movie Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Computer, we don't want to go to Magrathea yet. We want to follow the ships.
Oh, I'd love to, fella, but wouldn't you know it, my guidance system has been deactivated.
I met Thomas last year when I was speaking at the Yerkes Observatory, and I thought, whoa, this Hollywood actor must really love space. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm your host, Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up. The show that takes you deep into the cosmos or just to the telescope in your backyard to learn more about what makes this amazing universe of ours so great. My guest today is actor, comedian, and screenwriter, and an absolute train wreck for any serious podcast, Thomas Lennon. So let me set the scene. Given my Tour of the Universe talk at the Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin, this is the talk where I fly the audience virtually around the universe from the surface of the Earth to the edge and make lots of stops along the way. There's about 60 people in the audience, but when I make a stop at Saturn, there's this sandy-haired, mustachioed man near the back of the room that looks really familiar. By the time I pass Pluto, I'm convinced I know him from somewhere. He's famous. Maybe an astronaut. And after leaving the Milky Way, I got it. It's definitely, absolutely Canadian astronaut and social media sensation Chris Hadfield. Oh my gosh, Chris Hadfield is in my audience. After my presentation, I casually bump into Chris Hadfield in the hall, only to find out it is not Chris Hadfield, but instead Thomas Lennon. What the heck is he doing here?
Hi, this is Thomas Lennon. I am a writer for the most part and an actor somewhat. I'm best known as Lieutenant Dangle from Reno 911. I wrote the Night at the Museum films. And for your listeners, I am the voice of the Heart of Gold in A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Eddie, your shipboard computer. It's nice to be here, Dean, in the room where I met you. We're sitting in the room where we first met.
Yeah, that is exactly true. We're here at the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, and I gave a talk here, and you were in the audience, and I was like looking at you in the back. I was like, wait a second, is that guy an astronaut? Like, you have an astronaut vibe. I think you should play Chris Hadfield, a Canadian astronaut that's famous for having a mustache and playing guitar.
No, I see what you're saying about that guy. I'd have to lose a couple pounds, to be honest, though. I've seen him. He's real slim. Everybody gets real slim in space. I can't explain why, but it seems to work.
Chris Hadfield here aboard the International Space Station. We keep busy on board the space station. Long days, lots of work, physical exercise. At the end of it, you're tired.
I heard an interview you did on another podcast about the, you know, newfound thing of celebrities going into space, and you had some pretty interesting takes on that. What's your thought of celebrities going into space, and if they asked you, would you do it? These are two very different questions.
One, I'll be so psyched when they ask me, because it'll be like, I'm finally a celebrity big enough, you know, to go beyond the Hollywood squares and into the lower stratosphere. Would I go into space? I've actually thought when I was a little kid and went to the Air and Space Museum. Later, I did go on to write the Night at the Museums, including the one that's set mostly at the Air and Space Museum. I've always looked at the compartments and known that space was not an option for me. Any space travel would never be an option for me, just simply based on the claustrophobia of it all. Could you conceive of getting into something like one of the Apollo capsules? You know, in a lot of movies, it's nice. You get to see people kind of like floating around and there's a little bit of stuff around them. And then you look at the actual vehicles and they are a sarcophagus, you know, you're diapered up in a sarcophagus. And I'm not saying I don't want to do that because that would certainly be something I would try. But I don't think I could. I don't think space travel is a possibility for me until, you know, 2001, you know, where there's a loop that I can jog on with, you know, invented gravity.
But what if I throw in one extra little thing to the space travel? And that is, you know, you could either design your own outfit like Katy Perry or they provide you with teeny tiny space shorts.
First of all, you mentioned Andor, which is a great show that I haven't seen. And I know you love all of the Star Wars canon, all of it. And second of all, if I go to space, I'm wearing that Katy Perry outfit already just for the joie de vivre.
So, yeah, you mentioned that you were one of the screenwriters for the Night at the Museum series. And I mean, did you have this idea that this thing was really going to take off and be such a hit? And, you know, just writing in general, how does that work for you? Like, is writing better than acting? What would you rather do? Write, direct, act?
To me, writing really is probably the number one. And I mean, I've written a lot of things. Some have been enormous flops. Some have been big hits. But I always sort of write with the same intention and everything. And Night at the Museum, the idea seemed so perfect. It's based on a very, very short children's book that's about as long as as the book Goodnight Moon. It's very short, mostly pictures. And then we were given the book to look at, and we did the thing that we always do, which is we think about like, okay, so everything in this museum comes to life at night, and the guard takes it for a walk around the park. And then in the morning, if you see the guard asleep, it's only because he was up all night walking the dinosaurs around the reservoir in Central Park. And so we're like, well, this is an amazing idea. And who doesn't love the notion that everything in the museum turns on when everybody goes to bed? So like, how could we create some kind of mythology around that it makes just enough sense to hold water as a movie. It was always a lot of fun and fun to make it almost make sense, you know? And one of the neat things is we actually wrote a draft for the first version of the second Night at the Museum. It ended up being at the Air and Space Museum, which was fun and one of the great museums in the world. And the place where I knew I would never go into space because I saw the outfits and the seating. The seating's really rough. Anyway, Night at the Museum, writing is a lot of fun. I write every day, even just for fun. Like, I love to write. I will get up and write. I'll get up some days at 3 or 4 in the morning and start writing until the world wakes up. And then I'll do it again, the way some people like to roller skate or play guitar or have a yo-yo. It's my happiest place to be, even if it's just for me.
Well, and, you know, getting something like that, the Night at the Museum, it's a short story. And then, but did that give you like this kind of freedom? Like it had this overarching part, but then you could go with it wherever you wanted.
Exactly. There was really not, the great thing is there wasn't really that much there, which was fun. It's kind of fun. It's a great sort of thought experiment sometimes for someone to give you like, okay, here's an idea. Like we're going to make a movie about Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin. And it'll be, you know, the day that Albert Einstein came to Yerkes. And like, you know, like now you have two things. You just have Albert Einstein came here. He only wanted to see Niagara Falls and Yerkes Observatory, where we're sitting right now, which is pretty cool. And so what was that like? You know, like now fill in all of the blanks around that. Like, what was the day like? Because like, if you see a picture of him here, everybody's in wool. Everybody's in 8 layers of black wool. And it must have been a really interesting, and they came by train, of course, you know, like start to fill in all the details of what was Einstein's day like here, you know? Maybe I shouldn't talk about it because maybe this would be a great new Night at Museum movie and they're still making them. So I'm just going to save whatever Einstein's day was like here at Yerkes in case you thought of that also. You don't have the rights to that. Well, if you go fast, you do.
Well, speaking of inspirational, I am here to pitch an idea for you. I'm hoping to inspire you to write a new series called A Night at the Observatory. I'm thinking rom-com, buddy comedy, maybe starring a youngish grain astronomer with glasses that's kind of skinny but talks a lot on the radio a lot. You know, it's something like that. What do you think?
Okay, Dean, here's how we do this movie about you. You're working here at Yerkes Observatory, but way across the lake, there's sort of a lonely widow, and she's got a telescope. So you're looking at space, but she's looking at you. And then you keep not quite meeting. It could be a lot of fun. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this one. And then it turns out she's an alien. She was always here. She was here to make sure that you didn't see the attack because you were the only guy that knows how to work the telescope here. So she was an advanced team. See, this is where my mind starts to break because everybody's like, we could have made this a fun rom-com. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. So Dean knows how to work the telescope. So there's like a few people left that can work a refracting telescope. So the aliens who are coming know that if you can see through that, you know they're coming. So they got to send somebody in. They got to send an advanced team, a honeypot to get you the hell out of the equation. That's our movie. It may not be good, but we're already filming it because we're here.
Holy smokes. That's like that wrote itself. It's unbelievable. So that's what every astronomer's significant other is. They're really an alien trying to distract them from the invasion.
Correct.
That blew my mind because I know all these astronomers and their significant others. They are definitely aliens. That's for sure. Wow. This is why talk to geniuses. This is what comes out. Is this what happens? So yeah, let's write this.
Dean, we're sitting here in Yerkes where Albert Einstein came as a relatively young man. But if we're being honest, I've written way more movies than him, like by a lot. Like it's not even if you're going head to head, me and Einstein. I mean, mustaches, obviously, both legends, but sheer screenplays. I got to have him beat, right? We're going to have to look it up and we'll be back after a short break. But I think I've written more movies than Albert Einstein.
You've also worked with a lot of different characters out there, but who's the most Einstein person you worked with?
No one I've ever met could do this equation that's on the board behind us right now, which is the white dwarf stars equation. I'm going to go ahead and say the smartest person I've ever met, and maybe he's just pretending, but it seems like Shatner seems quite bright. I recently was at an event with Shatner. I was in my Reno 911 outfit. He was zipping by and he was on like a scooter. But William Shatner zipped by me and he said, "Great legs." And I thought, I can actually die happy now because Admiral Kirk said, "Great legs." There's another story. Picard asked me about my legs also. I've been around all the Enterprise captains in shorts, which is another whole story. Life choices. Be careful what you wish for, kids.
Well, Thomas, has been so fun chatting about all things space. We're going to solve this equation together afterwards and then maybe go up and see the biggest refracting telescope in the world.
Thanks, Dean. It was a lot of fun.
So people often ask me, what is my favorite astronomy or space movie? In fact, Thomas Lennon asked me too. And, you know, I usually hem and haw and I don't answer very quickly because, you know, what really is going through my mind? All the really bad space movies. You know, Armageddon, of course. Apocalypto, they totally messed up that eclipse scene. Various Star Wars films. So I go negative first because it's really difficult to watch space movies that get things so blatantly wrong. It drives me crazy.
Captain America here blew the landing by 26 miles.
How the hell do you know that?
Because I'm a genius.
For example, one thing that really bothers me in movies is how they portray sunrises. You know, like when a director wants to show the passage of time or to reinforce that it's morning and a new day has dawned. But in films, you gotta notice the direction that the sun rises. If the show is taking place in the United States, Canada, Europe, or most of Asia, the sun should rise above the horizon and travel up and to the right. Up and to the right. Not many sunrises in film happen that way. They too often go up and to the left. Well, why is that? Because the camera person doesn't know where to aim the camera to catch the sun rising. I mean, it's below the ground. It could rise up anywhere. So to save time, and worst of all, save from hiring an astronomy consultant like me who could tell them where to point the telescope, they instead record a sunset. A sunset they can more obviously document, and the sun will appear to travel down and to the right until it's obscured by the horizon. So once you get that footage, all you gotta do to make a sun rise is to play it back in reverse. Thus, the sun will rise up and to the left. Now you know the trick. If you see a sunrise traveling up and to the left, better take place in Australia, or they just lost all respect from this here astronomer. Looking Up with Dean Regas is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds and I created the podcast in 2017. Ella Rowan and Carlos Lopez Cornu produce and edit our show and think I should totally grow a mustache like Thomas Lennon. All right, but I'm not wearing his short shorts from Reno 911. Janelle Walton is our vice president of content, and Ronnie Salerno is our digital platforms manager. Our theme song is Possible Light by Ziv Moran. Our social media coordinator is Hannah McFarlane, and our cover art is by Nicole Tiffany. I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.